session number 17984, Reel 2.
Jim Oates, Reel 2. So did you stay with the Royal Fusiliers?
We were sent then to Egypt. I think we landed at Alexandra, and then we went to a holding area. We nearly got into action with the Fusiliers, because while we were in Egypt, and I forget, I don't know if it was Ireland or what, but we were suddenly mustered to do a dawn invasion of a certain area. I don't know if that's Ireland or what, where our British troops were, but were under heavy pressure. All our gear was stowed up and taken away, and we'd just been fighting battle order, ready to move at dawn on three fast French frigates. But before we moved, almost at the crack of dawn, the message came in, abandon, because the Germans had overrun and overwhelmed those that we were going to reinforce, and we would have sailed into trouble, so it was called off.
What date would this have been about? So in 1942?
About 1943. Because we spent so long, I was called into the army 1942 January. We spent a long while in England. So that would have been in the early days of 1943. And so that was called off. We were disappointed because all our personal stuff had gone in our kit bags and taken away somewhere. It took a while for that to come back. And while we were there in the holding station, the word came round that Scottish Battalion, 2nd Battalion HLI, was going to be reformed for mountain training, skiing, living in the snow, and volunteers could make application to join.
Where were you when you heard this?
Somewhere in Egypt, somewhere between Cairo, Alexandria, Port Said, somewhere around there. So myself and two of my mates who we were close, they called us the Three Musketeers. They were two big chaps. One was an ex-ring boxer, he was a powerful chap. We decided we would volunteer because you had to pass an extra physical test to be A1 plus for living up on a mountain and doing all this work. So the joke between the three of us, because they were two big, powerful chaps, they were me, only a 10 stone, that I hope I pass because they will, and we keep together. We had our medical, our A1 physical. I passed and they didn't, the two big chaps. So I lost my two mates, but there you are.
Where did you join the HLI then?
I joined the HLI, that would be somewhere in 1943.
In Egypt?
In Egypt, well, it wasn't so much in Egypt. Let me get this straight. I don't think where. Because they had to reform the battalion. Now, where that was done, I can't tell where we went after we joined the HLI, because we were then taken to Italy and then taken across to the Netherlands for a mountain on the borders of Syria and Lebanon. But the HLI was reformed. Those that had passed the A1 plus were going to be trained as mountaineers and ski snow. Those that didn't in the battalion, keep them within a battalion, it was necessary that on the mountains or whatever they was going to train us for, we would need porters. when stuff came to us, there would be, say, the first echelon. They would take it up to the second echelon, maybe the third one. We would be waiting at the third one to take it up. So they became porters and stayed within the battalion. It was reformed. Our whole company was no more than about 30 strong. We weren't divided into platoons. The company was company HQ, but then you had patrols. We were called patrols, not platoons. The cobblers in the battalion, we still needed cobblers, but we also needed someone to make the ski wax and look after our snow gear. So they were trained to make ski wax, and it was a joke to us because the bulk of this ski wax they made for us was three types. One for soft snow, one for general use, and one for speed. But the bulk of it was made, believe it or not, from gramophone records. The old celluloid, they were melted down to make the main body, and so that was added extras, which I'm not too much aware of now. I know beeswax and things like that, and they learned how to control the amount of beeswax for speed wax or trekking wax for soft snow.
Did this wax work?
Oh yeah. Yes, it did work. It did work. We still kept our pipers, and they were very necessary later on when we were in combat, so that the Germans knew it was us and not partisans, guerrillas. We always kept our pipes. Somewhere in Yugoslavia is a set of bagpipes. We'll come to that later on in one of the raids. So eventually when the battalion was formed, we were then taken to Italy and boarded the boats, taken above Beirut. I'm looking at the maps. Mount Sanin we went to, Mount Sanin. Now, I'm not quite sure, but it doesn't matter. Mount Sanin, I can't see it on the map. I see one or two other mounts, but Mount Sanin, obviously, was either just in Syria or on the borders of Syria and Lebanon.
How did you cope with the training?
Oh, very well. Very well. The training was... When we went to Mount Sanin, we were taken there. The pioneers had gone ahead of us to prepare a base camp. Whilst it was dry and no snow, the base camp was comprised of big Nissen huts on block walling. We arrived before the snow because we had to take up possession of settling down before the snow came. So before the snow came, it was rocky and hilly, and so we were given the basic training in not mountaineering like climbing Mount Everest, but how to recognise the dangers of rock climbing, dangerous scree, and how to be safe. We were issued with crampons, and the gear we had was terrific. Not just an ordinary army kit bag, we had that, but the other kit bag was as big as what the Navy used, because it contained all our mountain snow gear. So we were learning the basics in rock climbing, the dangers and the safeties and that, waiting for the snow. Because eventually the snow came. And when the snow did finally arrive, by golly, did it snow? You get 4 feet overnight. Good job our doors opened in on our camp. Because when the first heavy drops of snow, you open the door, And all you had was a wall of snow. You had to dig your way out to get outside the billet. And of course the other joke, it's a joke, not true. We had outside toilets, naturally, usual army toilets, trench and the ground and a pole across and up around it, you know. And of course the snow also brought the animals, the wolves and that, down from the higher reaches of the mountain. We could hear them howling at night. Sometimes we would see the big paw marks where they walked over our huts. But the joke was, one of our chaps went out one night to the toilet, and he's sitting on his pole, it's night time, and suddenly he was, I'll say, confused. But then he looked around all at the same little torches glowing at him. It was wolves. He shot out as quick as he could. The wolves must have buggered off, you know. So the order went out. No one to use the toilets unless another soldier was out there with a rifle. It was good. The ski training was good. The first big joke, looking back there, I'll call it a joke. Our officers, we had all our gear, we had all our skis, all our snow gear, all our extra covering and snow shoes. But we couldn't do anything until our trainers came, instructors. And among them were our Olympic, the previous Olympic skiers. The officers got fed up waiting for the instructors, there was a hold up. And so all the snow had really arrived, you know. So they thought they would go out on a training patrol in the snow. And everywhere you went in the snow, you had to go by compass. Because going out, the features were never the same coming back. Depending on how where the wind's blowing. Whereas you might see a hill of snow this side. By the time you've gone up there, the wind's changed. So you had to work on compass. And if it really blitzed, so when I see television of the North Pole and South Pole, I can believe what I see, because if the snow came down hard with a strong wind, you literally could not see beyond the hands in your face. So our equipment, we all had toggles back and front. So when we went out on patrol or training, as soon as the wind started to blow, we were told to hook up. So you hooked up to the chap in front, so that you couldn't get lost. You stayed together as one chain. But coming back to what I started with, when the officers had a red face, waiting for the instructors, they decided, no, they were going to do an army manoeuvre, something like, I suppose, the First World War in India, you know. Troops up this side, troops up this side, set off. I wasn't on that, thank goodness. When they were due to return, they were late. Then it got later. Then we got worried. Good Lord, what's happened? Before we'd even think of mounting some sort of rescue or lighting fires to guide them in case they've bugged up their compass readings, or they did return in a helpless state because the officers had gone out with these snowshoes because it was soft snow to start with. And by the time they'd gone a hell of a long distance and was about to return, what they'd forgotten was those snowshoes had not been treated. They were brand new and arrived, and there's, you know, the racket type snowshoes. Well, because the cords on them had to be treated like you're treating them with linseed oil or something to stop them fraying. And what had happened? Because of the wet conditions, the wet snow, the damp snow, and the lots of the soldiers, their feet were going through the snowshoes, the strings were breaking. And when you've got to come back a long distance without snowshoes and snow up to your flipping knees or up to your hips, it takes a long while to get back. That was a red face for our poor officers.
Were you doing this training for very long?
I don't think it was that long. See, that's hazard a guess, and looking at some brief notes I've got there, I think our training took no more than about 6 to 8 months, 6 to 8 months.
So it must have been the winter of 43-44.
Yeah, yeah. It took no, but we. The main thing is, apart from the rock climbing, which came useful afterwards, we learned to live in the snow. And it really was an experience. That's why I always feel sorry when I hear of people in Scotland dying in the snow. Think, if only they had the training how to cope with snow, because we used to do it. We'd go out, all our food was dehydrated when we go out. We had methylated tablet things for heat. And when we had to stop, we'd find the nearest lee side of the snow, dig our way in, because we all had entrenching tools. Once we dug our way in, then dig our way down. And once we were down, we had waterproof sheets to lay on the floor in the snow hole. We would put pile snow up in front of our entrance to the snow hole, but stick our ski sticks through so that we could constantly keep air coming in. And believe it or not, it got so warm in those snow holes that we would take our clothes off, more or less. It got so warm in there with our little methylated tablets, and we'd melt snow and make ourselves a drink and even cook whatever there was to cook. But when we were out on training exercises like that, we were forbidden to shave or get our faces and hands wet because of when you came at frostbite. One sergeant, or corporal, I forget now, being, I suppose, army trained, he did shave, so he got frostbite in his face. That was the way of treatment. And yet the amazing thing in the snow that shook us, if the sun was shining and no wind, and we were doing pleasure skiing, you know, off parade, loose order, we were stripped down to shorts, bare. No matter how many degrees below, but it wasn't cold. No wind. It's only the wind that was the enemy.
Were they mostly Scotsmen in the battalion?
No, it was a lot of Scotsmen. I suppose breaking it up in our battalion, I suppose one would say about 60%. And the others were volunteers from all over, you know, Geordies, Welshmen.
Did they mix well together?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We got on well with the Scotsmen because they were Glaswegian-based. And obviously a lot of the English side were from the Fusiliers, which was a Cockney London regiment. And so us Cockneys got on well with the Glasgow Cockneys. So that was all right.
Did they tell you what you were preparing for?
No. I've looked back on that and pondered on that, and so one, I think I may be wrong, because you never know what high command's up to. I got a feeling when they decided to form a mountain snow battalion, probably because the war was still on, you know, they'd probably think of Sweden, Norway, something like that. I don't know.
And when you finished the training, what happened to you then?
Uh, When we finished the training, we were taken back to Italy, where we had nice leave. We had plenty of leave, our battalion. And then we were shipped off to what was known then as Yugoslavia, to an island off the mainland, which is now Croatia, looking at the new maps, the island of Brač, Otok Brač, Yugoslav Otok. I learned to speak a bit of Yugoslav around there, Govoric Slovenski, you know.
What does Otok mean?
I think it means mount, island.
So you arrived on the island of Brač in 1944?
Yeah, we replaced the American Rangers. They were already there with our commandos. Our 40th, I think 40th something, commandos. And the Rangers were pulled out and we replaced them.
What did you find on the island?
Very bleak.
Was it winter when you arrived, or summer, or what?
I can't remember. I dare say if I checked my diary, I could get in here now. The other islands, Korčula and Brač, they were German occupied. This was the one island that wasn't. And on the way to Vis, did I say Brač? We went to Brač.
Yes, you did.
That's a mistake. It was Vis. V-I-S. It was Vis, because Brač was German-occupied, as was Korčula, and Vis was a bit further out than the others. On our trip over, was a bit dodgy, because the Germans had left lots of floating mines in the water. So naturally, because they turned up the records and I was a sniper, my job in our boat was wherever someone alerted a mine, my job was to shoot at the horn sticking up. And that was a bit of fun, that was. The explosion. They cleared them all out eventually. The American Rangers didn't do us any favours at all, because the island, no rivers, things like that. The island had relied on wells, plenty of wells. And the American Rangers evidently thought they could improve the wells and with explosives or something to improve the wells. They ruined a lot of the wells. As a consequence, I don't know how the commanders got on. Funny enough, we never met the commanders. Not actually met the commanders, but they were there because they relieved us once and took over something the Germans were going to surrender to us. But we had to put out with so many casualties. But because of the Yanks ruining a lot of the wells, all our water now was brought over from the mainland in 2-gallon cans. And we were living in two-man tents. Funny enough, I just got rid of my tent. I had brought one home, gave it to my grandchildren. Living in two-man tents. And you get that four or five soldiers got to... And all we were allowed to use for water, our soldiers, the main water went to the cookhouse and other things, was a 2-gallon can of water. Now, in the army, you have to do your own dobe. You've got to wash your socks, your clothes. Do you imagine? And you wanted that water for washing and shaving of a morning. You imagine four or five chaps sharing 2 gallons of water to wash, shave, wash their socks. If you was shrewd, like I could be at times, you managed to get in early first before, because the last chaps had to scrape all the scum off the top before they could use the water under the scum. And that's a fact. Made worse because I don't know where they came from, but sleeping in these two-man trenches, tents, and some sort of ground flea or tick. And it was awful, you'd wake up scratching yourself.
Did the troops stay healthy, or were there any...
Oh, yeah. No, we stayed healthy, all right. Yeah, we stayed healthy, all right. There was a little cottage near us that we used as an HQ, our company commander, but it belonged to a elderly couple. Funny enough, his son was still there. Why he wasn't in the... I don't know, in their partisan forces. And I naturally, as I said before, knees under the table, I got well in with this old couple. So I was all right for drinks and the odd meal. And as a consequence, I used to write to Betty. And Betty used to send over, because we still got all our mail wherever we went. Needles, cotton, buttons. And this old lady was thrilled to get that. So it worked both ways, you know. It was good. The part, when we went to this, on the boat going over, now this is fact, we were warned that once we arrived on the island, we came under Tito's law. And if we played about and mucked about, hold on, Bessie, please. And we were warned on no account must we get involved with the female partisans. Because Tito's ruling was that if any of these female partisans was made pregnant, whoever made her pregnant was going to be shot. And that was a fact. Likewise, anybody caught stealing would be shot. And as a consequence, when the partisan troops were coming through our lines, we could leave all our stuff outside our little tents. No fear of the partisans picking it up, stealing or anything like that. And they were tough women, their partisan ladies. I remember one patrol coming back, coming through, all tired as they're coming through our lines, bringing up the rear with two female partisans, big strong girls, carrying, half carrying, a couple of the men partisans who were exhausted and then it's over tough. We got on well with them, but not intimately. Not intimately. Learned to sing their songs. Hey, commissar, hey, commandeer, stravo, 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 drugevier, comrades, you know. We learnt those songs. They let us down on one occasion. And I've been tossing over in my mind was whether when we raided Bratch or whether we had to go on the mainland to raid a German contingent